We are talking today about Musaf. At least that's what I announced. The announcement was that we were going to do Musaf. So first of all, let's just define the word of Musaf. Any volunteers from down south?
Additional.
Okay, additional. And it's like the Hebrew word or name that we know, which is Yosef. In other words, when Yosef was named, his mother, Rachel, said, Yosef Hashem li bein acher. May God add to me, for me, another child. So that word, Nosaf, whatever the original root is, one of the letters falls out in Hebrew grammar, but the word is Musaf, which is translated generally as the additional service. Now, I do have to start off, you'll all forgive me because I say this all the time, in memory of a good friend whose name was Bob Silver. He was the president of the shul in Austin. He passed away this year. That was when I was in Florida for that time period. And in the Art Scroll Siddur, if you'll just turn for one moment to the Musaf Shmona Esrei. And if you'll turn, I have said this in shul a few times, but on page 466, you see the page there. Has above and below the line, and there was a nice man in his 90s who would always insist after I would announce the page, he would say above the line or below the line, and all I have to say after he passed away was above the line, and the entire show would start laughing because that was his thing. Anyway, if you see it says here, the section is called in Hebrew Kedushas Hayom, the holiness of the day. It has for an ordinary Sabbath, you say this, this, and that. And where the line is, on a Shabbos Rosh Chodesh, the following is substituted. So there are two different texts for the body, let us call it, of the Shmona Esrei, one for a Shabbos Rosh Chodesh, and one for an ordinary Shabbos. And Bob Silver said to me one time, what do you mean an ordinary Shabbos? There's no such thing as an ordinary Shabbos. Every Shabbos is special, is unique, is beautiful. I said, you're absolutely right. Why don't you write the publisher and tell them what you think? So he composed the letter, we worked on the letter together, and he wrote them, and he said, you know, I'm not that familiar with everything, I'm sort of new for things, I'm the president of an Orthodox shul, and I saw where you say an ordinary Shabbos, and that doesn't look right to call a Shabbos ordinary, and could you please tell me of something like that? And they wrote him back. They wrote back a letter and said, you know, sounds right. And congratulations on being president of the shul. They sent him a book on the 613 mitzvot. And then, let's just see for a second over here. Not this one, but on some of the later Siddurim, they changed the word from ordinary to a regular Shabbos. Now you say regular is not that much better, but it's ordinary in our term just, you know, means unimportant is ordinary. And here they changed it on the later version to on a regular Shabbos. So they actually listened to him, and I thought to myself, I said, the fact that they didn't ignore the letter, and then they sent him a book, well, they're very smart businessmen in doing that.
Also, that they thought about it, they discussed it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah, if I were to reword it, I would have said, on Shabbat,
except
for Shabbat.
Simpler. Right. So if you'd like to have an experiment, write them a letter and see what happens after that.
They're going to say, who is the instigator?
Oh, well, actually, you're causing me to skip ahead to something that I wasn't going to do. But since you're saying it, I'm going to say, you know, with tongue-in-cheek as follows. Are women obligated to say Musaf or not? So let's go first. We spoke in the past about the obligation of women to daven. Men have an obligation to daven. Women have an obligation to daven. Why do women have an obligation to daven? If davening takes place at a particular time, and in general, women are not obligated, what's called in Hebrew, mitzvah sasei shazman groma, a positive mitzvah that has to be done at a particular time, women are not obligated in that mitzvah. So example, tefillin, which are to be put on during the day, women are not obligated in tefillin. Talis, which is tzitzis, which is ureisem, so you should see them, is during the day. Women are not obligated in doing it. All of the mitzvahs lo sase, the negative mitzvahs, both men and women are equally obligated not to do whatever that particular thing is. All of those mitzvahs sase, positive mitzvahs, which are associated with a negative mitzvah, since women are obligated in the negative mitzvah, they're also obligated in the positive mitzvah. So therefore, women are obligated in Kiddush on Shabbos just like men are. Even though it's at a particular time, it's only one day a week. Since women are obligated not to work on Shabbos, they're also obligated to make Kiddush on Shabbos. Prayer, women are obligated because the Gemara says simply, prayer is asking for your needs. Men have needs, women have needs. So of course women are also obligated in tefillah, in prayer. The Shabbos prayers, especially Musaf, do not have any personal needs. There's nothing that asks for our personal needs there. We ask God, we build a base, make the shrine, all of those things like that. But there aren't personal needs, so there's a discussion back and forth. Are women obligated in Musaf or not? The practical importance of this is, and this is what I try to say every once in a while, if a woman comes to shul and she comes at Musaf time or Torah reading time, and it comes to Shmona Esrei, should a woman say Shachris or should a woman say Musaf? So a woman should say Shachris because Shachris is the main obligatory one. The same thing, by the way, probably applies to a man also, if he comes late, that he should say Shachris, because Shachris is supposed to come first anyway. I only have time to daven one. So it should be Shachris. And likewise, so again, if a woman comes late, so now I'm pulling my tongue out of my cheek and hopefully not putting my foot in my mouth. So if you could write the letter and say, I think you should write it this way, maybe they'll write back and say, I didn't know that women were so interested in Musa. Okay, so if my foot is not in my mouth with that, let us now come back.
Women are not obligated to do positive mitzvot because of the time element. It doesn't mean that they're prevented or told not to do it. Why aren't women wearing a talis and a yarmulke in an Orthodox shul?
So let's start off with a yarmulke. A yarmulke isn't a mitzvah.
Okay, but
it's not a mitzvah. Do you, if you've ever seen people who drop a yarmulke, pick it up and kiss it. There's no religious significance to that. As far as covering one's head, men and women are supposed to cover their head. So it's not a yarmulke, not this particular thing. So if you ask me why women don't cover their hair, I don't have a good answer for you. The reason is because their mothers didn't do it. Their grandmothers may have done it, but what happened, the covering of the hair of women is something that fell by the wayside for a major portion of the Jewish people. So, and that is, even Orthodox women did not do it. But there is no answer as to why not. So that is, men and women both are supposed to cover their hair.
This is why you wear a hat.
Yeah. So though women who wear a hat when coming to shul or a chapelet or whatever it is are showing recognition of that basic principle that it's an appropriate thing to do. And therefore, shul very often will have both yarmulkes in the front and chaplets. You call them chaplets here?
No, so,
yeah. There are people who take them home with them. They call them chapel, because they chop it when they go away afterward. So as far as that, as far as a talis, why women do not wear one, it's just because since women are not obligated to do so, those women who are doing it at the present time are very often doing it for many reasons. How's that for a good euphemism? And therefore, it's not something that's required. If a woman comes into shul wearing a talis, probably most Orthodox rabbis would not say anything.
But the men
would. The men would say something if someone wears a red shirt when he comes in. Oops, excuse me. When they come into shul. I didn't say. In other words, if you're asking why people do so, why people, whoever people is, that I can't answer. Okay, the reason is because it's different, and people talk about anyone who does anything that is different. So that's that, okay. Now coming back to.
You want to wear a
towel?
No, we invented
synagogues a lot of times, especially if they have like a bar mitzvah class. That's the river class for the older women. Yeah. Once they have that class, then they'll come with a talis on.
Right.
But why not?
Yeah. Now, as far as women wearing tefillin is a long, long discussion for another time. I'm not sure you answer that. But since on Shabbos, when we have Musaf, we don't wear tefillin, so we'll save that discussion for another time. Just to point out that there is one day, at least one day, that tefillin are worn and that Musaf is set. And that's on Rosh Chodesh. On Rosh Chodesh, tefillin are worn for Shacharis, but they're taken off for Musaf. And likewise, some people put on, whether you put on tefillin during Chol HaMoed, the intermediate days of Sukkot and Pesach, there are different customs, but those who do put it on take it off for Musaf. So bottom line is, since we're doing Musaf today, we're not doing tefillin at all. That's what I do. Now, when may Musaf be said? What is the time for Musaf? So the time for Musaf is all day. By that I mean, we know that the time for Mincha, let us call it the afternoon. From some starting point, starting from the half an hour after astronomical noon till evening. Evening is either sunset or later when the stars come out, different opinions. The time for Maariv, the evening, is from whenever Mincha ends, including a time of an hour and a quarter before sunset. For example, on Friday nights now, we are davening Maariv while it is still light outside, and during the summer we may do so, until morning. And the time for Shacharis is from morning till noontime. Really, the time is till a third of the day is the time for Shacharis. Approximately about 10:30 at this time of year. Approximately, that's the time. If one hasn't davened Shacharis by 10:30, one still can daven Shacharis till noontime. So what is the time for Musaf? The time for Musaf is all day long. As soon as Shacharis is over, if I daven Shacharis at the sunrise is now about 6 o'clock. If I daven Shacharis and I finish Shacharis at 6:30, I can daven Musaf. I can daven Musaf till sunset time also. So the time of Musaf is the entire day, but we say Musaf immediately after Shacharis. We have things in between. That's what I'm going to talk today about, the things that come in between. How late do we... community, American Jews, how late do we sometimes say Musaf? We do say Musaf on Rosh Hashanah. We sometimes start Musaf at at noon or later. And on Yom Kippur, we can start Musaf at 2 o'clock in the afternoon or later. There are some places which try not to start Musaf so late on Yom Kippur.
They can get home earlier.
They generally, in Israel, in general, davening is on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur is much quicker than our davening in America. There's often a long break of maybe 2 hours or longer during the day. But the reason why they try to daven Musaf earlier is because in precedence, Mincha, the afternoon prayer, is more important than Musaf. And therefore, once it comes the time for Mincha, maybe I should have Mincha first and Musaf later, since it takes precedence, since Mincha is more important. So that's why they try to always have Musaf start before the time of Mincha. And that will also guarantee davening being earlier. Okay? So that is that. So now I want to share with you some of the things of what takes place between Shacharis and Musaf. And before you turn, let me just ask you, where does Musaf start? We all go to Shul on Shabbos, so where does Musaf start? What's the prayer that we start Musaf with? Or the announcement that I always make? Which Chatzi Kaddish? You didn't fall into the trap.
They're readers.
No. So the answer is, let's take a look on... on page 460 in the Art Scroll, in the Birnbaum, on page... 389, correct. Take a look at the top of the page. What does it say? Yeah, the top. No, the heading on the page. It says Shacharis, or morning service. Where does the person who is davening Musaf start? He always starts at Yikum Purkan. And normally, most rabbis are going to announce Musaf starts on page whatever with Yikum Purkan. But in truth, all of that belongs to Shacharis. Musaf really starts with the Shemona Esrei, with the Amidah. So what we'll take a look at today is the things that are in between. After, we're going to start after the Torah reading, because the Torah reading for sure belongs before. So in the Art Scroll on page 448 and in the Birnbaum on page 377, Yikum Purkan. I'm using the World of Prayer by Rabbi Eli Monk, who was in Paris in France, and he wrote on prayer some very, very beautiful things. I am going to be saying some of the things directly from here because he phrases it very, very beautifully. So let's take a look at Yikum Purkan for a moment in English. May salvation arise. I'm reading from the Art Scroll, but either one is fine. It's actually good to have both. I'm going to read from the Birnbaum because that's what's most used. So on page 378, may salvation arise from heaven, may grace, kindness, and mercy, long life, ample sustenance, and divine aid, physical health, perfect vision, and healthy children, will never neglect the study of the Torah, be granted to our scholars and teachers, to the holy societies that are in the land of Israel and the land of Babylon, to the heads of the academies and the chiefs of the captivity, oh, interesting translation, to the presidents of the colleges and the judges of the towns, to their disciples and the disciples of their disciples, and to all who study Torah. May the King of the universe bless them, prolong their lives, increase their days, and add to their years. May they be saved and delivered from all distress and disease. May our Lord, who is in heaven, be their help at all times. And let us all say, Amen. So, hey, that's pretty good. We're all trained well. Okay, so now, this prayer, just I'm going to read one line in Hebrew just so you hear. Yikum purkan min shemaya chinah v'chizda v'rachmi v'chaya erichei. In a siddur which is called Rinat Yisrael, which is a popular siddur in Israel, and it has this prayer, is one of the unique prayers in that it is translated. And on the side of this prayer in the Israeli siddur, it has it written in Hebrew. Because Yikum Purkan there is Aramaic. So Israelis do not understand Aramaic well. It's not a common language, and therefore, when there's something in Aramaic in this particular Israeli siddur, so they translate into Hebrew just like we would translate into English for us. And I once had a taxi driver in Israel, and we started talking, and he says he comes from this place in Kurdistan, and they speak, the family language over there is Aramaic. I said, your family? He said, yes, he grew up, his parents spoke Aramaic. They're all of the Jews, and that's one of the last regions where people speak Aramaic. So I say, you speak Aramaic? Oh, wonderful. Could you please tell me, how do you say the driver honked his horn because a bicycle was going across the highway? So he says to me, I can't say that in Aramaic. There's no words in Aramaic for all of those things. The honk, the horn, the bicycle crossing the highway. I said, oh, come on. Anyway, I know it was unfair of me because Aramaic is a language which is very old, has not been spoken by most of the Jewish people for a long time, and therefore doesn't have the modern words. This paragraph, the two paragraphs of Yikum Purkan, which are found in the davening, are in Aramaic because they were composed in Babylonia, and you see inside when we said of the chiefs, the heads of the academies and the chiefs of captivity, that are in the holy societies in the land of Israel and the land of Babylon, it's because it was composed in Babylonia and the Jews spoke Aramaic there. It was the more common language. As a matter of fact, even in Israel, it was a more common language. As I pointed out before, that in the Beit HaMikdash, in the temple, there were the collection boxes for the Matzis HaShekel, for the half shekel, which was given as the dues to the Beit HaMikdash. And the boxes were marked, those who've heard this from me before, forgive me. The boxes were marked with the following. Two abbreviations. There were at least two boxes. There were more for other things, but these two boxes were collection boxes that people put the money in for the half shekel. The half shekel is supposed to be given every year. It's given before Pesach time, the beginning of the fiscal year, and not everybody paid their taxes on time. So when they showed up, some people had to pay last year's taxes, and some people were paying this year's taxes. So this is for the new one. This is for the old one. The one for the new one is this word is taklin, and this is did you hear somebody say chadash? But it doesn't say chadash, it says chadatin. And this one is the same thing, tough, and the other word is atikin. Oh, what is this now? So let's go as follows. This what is this equal to? This equals shekalim. Taklin equals shekalim. Why? Because in Aramaic, a taf equals a shin in Hebrew. So this word, instead of being chadash, is chadetin. In other words, again, if you just change that up to this, because in Aramaic, a shin of Hebrew becomes a tav. So example, in the Gemara, this word over here is not a battle cry of Japanese, but it is short, an ox. So the word in Tura, did I do that?
Yes.
In Tura. So in Aramaic, there's certain letters which are exchanged for a Hebrew word. This word over here, the Zion in Hebrew equals a Dalet in Aramaic. So therefore, also, Aramaic, you can generally see that it's Aramaic because it ends with an aleph instead of a hey. So this word over here, mitzvah in Aramaic equals in Hebrew, again, the a dalet in Aramaic equals a Zion in Hebrew, so this word is
Mizbeah.
Mizbeah in Aramaic is Mizbeah. Now, if you want to, if you know Hebrew and you want to learn Aramaic, the easy way to do it is say the Targum each week on the Parsha. Because the Targum, the Aramaic translation, which is found inside of many, many Chumashim, was said by people in order to be able to understand the Chumash, because they didn't understand Hebrew as well as they understood Aramaic. Again, the Aramaic is the power English. So therefore, in Shulchan Aruch, it says, you're supposed to go over the Parsha, Shnayim Mikra Ve'echa Targum. The Parsha twice and the Targum one time to be able to understand. So many people say we should do it with Rashi because the Targum doesn't help us. Although Rashi does very often quote it. So just coming back, there's one more word over here, and that's this word over here. This again, these are the new shekel, Taklin Chadatin, Shkalim Chadashim, and this is Taklin Atikim. So Atikim is last year's taxes. So what's this word? No exchange with a Hebrew word, but with an English word. If you were a Taimani, how would you pronounce an ayin? Yes, exactly. Did you say mm or did you say mm? Okay, if you were Taimani, you would pronounce it with an ayin. So that, this word atikin, just I'm going to add an n inside of it for us to see for a moment, and look at this.
Atikin.
What's the English word?
Antique.
Exactly. And I didn't make this up just now, that is. Okay, so that is, the word atik is like the word antique in English. I'm sure the etymology is the same word. Okay. We're back to Yom Kippur now, written in Aramaic. So this is a prayer. If you just, let's say, if we would summarize the prayer, for whom is this prayer being made over here? This is for those who study the Torah, those who teach it, those who expound on it, and those who strengthen the institutions which are there for the studying and the teaching of the Torah. So it's very appropriate to be saying this when, what does this follow after? This follows after the Torah reading. In other words, we've just completed the reading of the Torah. We've just completed the Haftarah. So now we say we're praying for the people who are the teachers of the Torah, because they're the ones who make sure that we have it. Now, some of the words over here are, that we should see, it is called the Holy Societies. So in Hebrew it is on line 4, 1, 2, 3, 4 of the prayer, it has the Limaranan Rabbanan, our masters and our teachers, rabbis, Havurasa Kadisha, holy, yeah, so now you know the word Hevra Kadisha. So this is Havurasa Kadisha. Is it the same thing? Not necessarily over here. This isn't talking about specifically Hevra Kadisha. We have more recently called the people who prepare the bodies for burial the Hevra Kadisha, the Holy Society, because the work that they are doing. This Havurasa Kadisha is all of those people who do the holy work of God. And next comes Havurasa Kadisha, and afterwards comes the Ba'ara the Israel, the Diva Vavel, those who are in the land of Israel and that in Babylonia. Now, just again, another Aramaic equivalent, the word Ara equals, if you look at the Hebrew spelling, Bi, the Bez is in, the last word on line 4, Bi is in, Ara, leave the Ayin off, excuse me, the Aleph off, because that's equal to the Hebrew Hey, so it's not necessarily part of the root word, and we're left with Aleph, Resh, Ayin. And I said that this meant what? This meant the land of Israel. So Aleph, Resh, Ayin equals what in Hebrew?
Eretz,
which is another one of the letters which are exchanged. That is, the tzaddik in Hebrew equals an ayin in Aramaic. No, it's easy to remember this one. Why? Because when we start off our Seder, we welcome people to join our Seder. And we say, Holach Ma'anya, this bread of affliction, the Acholu Avosana, that our fathers ate, Ba'ara de Mitzrayim, in the land of Egypt. By the way, that's one of the very, very few parts in the Seder that's in Aramaic, rather than Hebrew. So how can we say it in Aramaic? Based on what it's in Aramaic.
I know.
So how can we say it in Aramaic? Why all of a sudden everything's in Hebrew? We said Kiddush in Hebrew. We say this in Hebrew. We say all these things in Hebrew. And we have, like, this is the one phrase, basically, the one phrase which is in Aramaic.
Isn't that long ago?
But, I'm sorry, John, I'm going to ask you, but aren't the other parts written? Actually, some of the parts are earlier than that. So the reason is because what is Halach Ma'anya in the Seder? It's an invitation to people to come and join. We say, whoever needs should come and eat with us. Whoever is hungry, let him come and eat. So what language should you say that? If I would open my door and I would say in Hebrew, because nobody's going to come into my house. If I say it in English, better watch out. So if I say this in Aramaic, it's an invitation to people to come. And if people know Aramaic better, so therefore it's appropriate that the invitation should be in Aramaic. Okay, so that's Ara. Now, the next thing is, after that, by the way, of course, the Jews in Babylonia, and we are basically Jews of Babylonia. In other words, every place outside of Israel is considered Babylonia. We say our prayers for the land of Israel and for Babylonia. Just an interesting thing, I say we are Jews in Babylonia. There are certain prayers that are started at different times in Israel and in Babylonia. Specifically, there's a prayer for rain that we say. There's one we start on Sukkot's time, Mashi Baruch Moedek Hashem, and there's also a prayer that is called the request for rain. The prayer of Geshem is, the Gemara calls it not a request, but a praise of God. It says, Mashiv HaRuach, God causes the wind to move, Umori HaGoshem, and to bring the rain down, but we haven't asked for rain yet. When we, in the weekday Shmon Esrei, we say, V'sein Talum Motar Livracha, give dew and rain. That's the request. But we don't start it right after we don't start it during Sukkot time. The reason, as we know, is because you wouldn't want rain to come in your Sukkot, so you're not going to ask for the prayer yet. In Israel, they started 2 weeks after the end of Sukkot. Why 2 weeks after? Because you need time to go home from Yerushalayim after Sukkot before you want rain. You don't want rain while people are traveling. You know, people driving up from Florida or something like that don't want rain at that time. So those people who are driving up from Florida say, please God, no rain, no rain, no rain. By the way, do you know what prayer the Kohen Gadol made on Yom Kippur when he went into the Holy of Holies? He said, don't listen to the prayers of the travelers. Because the travelers, the traveling salesmen, the people who go around, they don't want rain to come. So they're praying for no rain. But there are 5,000 farmers who need rain. What time do you have to leave? 11:30, you said?
A quarter to 12.
A quarter to 12. Oh, okay. I was thinking I was going to be short, but not me. I'm langer. Okay, so now the, so 1 second. They start in Israel 2 weeks after Sukkot. When do we start the prayer for rain? We start the prayer for rain on December, depending on what year it is, December 4th or 5th in certain leap years. So obviously the question is, how do we start on a secular date? That's the only thing that we have on a secular date. We started on a secular date. And why do we do it on a secular date? Because the secular calendar matches the seasons of the year. In other words, our Jewish calendar matches the movements of the moon. The secular calendar matches the movements of the sun. The seasons follow the sun. And therefore the prayers of the agricultural need of the rain will start based on the facts. The fact is that it, and therefore it starts at that time. But this was already in Babylonia. It's not something for America. Babylonia was called a fertile land. And even though if you look at most of Iraq, you'll say it's dry, but if you take a look and you see a map of the topography, you'll see the areas where the Jews lived, which is along the Tigris and the Euphrates rivers, that you'll see it's very green over there.
And they call it the Fertile Crescent.
The Fertile Crescent, which goes all the way to Israel. The Fertile Crescent is also the travel route coming to Israel, because you want to travel where there's water. You don't want to travel through anyway. So that whole land over there was where the Jews settled. When the Jews went into exile after the first temple, they went into the area there, and there was water there. It was low land, and it was a very lush land, and there was a lot of fruit there. So they started the prayers for rain later there. We, European Jews, American Jews, Canadian Jews, all start our prayer for the rain based on the time of Babylonia, because we're all considered Babylonians in regard to that. So what do they do in Australia? Australia is the southern hemisphere. Right. And so what do? Do they want rain during the summertime? In other words, December is summer there. Do they want rain?
End of November. Uh-huh. Actually into November. Springtime's November. Like November.
Just the opposite.
Right, so the opposite. Do they want rain? No, they don't. Okay. So now coming back over here. So the next thing is, that was the land of Israel and Babylonia. L'reishe chale u'l'reishe gal basa. Now, the word reish is the Hebrew rosh. That is the heads of the, I'm going to translate a kala and explain in a moment. L'reishe and the heads of gal basa is like the Hebrew word galut. But the vav is pronounced here, that is, the heads of the kala and the heads of the exile. So the first one is the kala. Now here the kala is not the bride, but this kala is an institution that existed in the time of the academies of Babylonia, and it's in a sense been started a little bit now, and people are actually doing this type of thing now. People have told me they go on vacation and they go to a university which has, if it's either an elder program or whatever the term is called, I think elder hostel, and people go to that, and what happens? They go to a university for 2 weeks or at some period when the university has vacation and their dormitories, etc., are available. There are special programs of study. This is called the Kala. And when did this take place? This is from the time of the Academies of Babylonia, that 2 months during the year, during the time around Pesach and around Sukkot, there was, if you call it, a retreat. And people went back to the yeshivas to study at that time. It was called the Kala, and people went. So the Reishei Kala are the people, the leaders of the academies, and the Reishei Galusa is the word is the exilarch, that is, the head of the communities that were in the time of the academies. So there were two heads of the Jewish community. There was the head of the yeshiva, the exilarch, and there was the Nasi, the prince, that was like a government-appointed person. So there was a division of powers, a sharing of powers, and there we have all kinds of stories in the Gemara about one being stronger than the other and one imposing his will on the people, things like that. But there's a prayer for the Reish Galusa, for the exilarch, the head of the Jewish community, who took care of many, many of the required things. Now, we continue and said, and here it then has, L'dayane, Dayan, the judges, D, Bava. Bava is, you know the Yiddish word of Bava, and everybody associates it with?
Oh,
you're all too good. I was going to say Misa. A Bava Misa. So what is a Bava Misa? A Bava Misa is a...
Like a white line?
Well, more specifically...
Exaggeration.
Bava Misa is a grandmother's story. In other words, that's the... Misa is a story. So Ma'asa is an action. Bava Misa is a grandmother's story. So, but Bava also in Aramaic means the gate. And therefore there are three volumes of the Gemara, Bava Kama, Bava Metzia, and Bava Basra, the three gates. So those are, that's the section of the Gemara that discusses torts, that discusses civil law. And apparently it was once one very, very long volume and was divided into three. And therefore it has a very, very descriptive name of first gate, last gate, and middle gate. But the court sat at the gate. If you remember, we just finished the book of Ruth, and it says over there that they went, Boaz called Ploni Almoni to the gate where the elders were, the court sat. Why did they sit at the gate? Because no doubt that's a place where everybody in the city comes through, and it's something that is able to be seen over there. A relative of a relative once said something to me, and she was unfortunately sitting Shiva, and I told her what she said at the time, and she said, I don't remember I said that. I said, no, I do. She said that when a person says to someone in Shiva, Hamakom Inatem Eshem, which is translated Hamakom, the place, the omnipresent, Inatem Eshem may comfort you, the Sof Sha'ar Avele Tzion, among the other, the mourners of Zion, Yerushalayim, and Jerusalem. So when we say Hamakom, the omnipresent, refers to God, because as we say, that the world is His place. So the one who is everywhere, may God comfort you. Now, what does it mean, the word Sha'ar? Does Sha'ar mean remnant, or does Sha'ar maybe mean like from the gates? That is, that the mourners would come into the city or be near the gates, and as they entered into the city, they would be comforted by the elders of the city, by the Dayanim, by the court that was sitting over there near the entrance to the city at the gate. So that they say, Hamakom she said, that the maqam, the place of where you're coming through and you're receiving this comfort, together with Sha'ar, the other mourners of Zion in Jerusalem. Okay, so again, Vava means that the gates, that is, the Dayana, the judges at the gates, the whole Talmideum, all their students, the whole Talmide Talmideum, and the students of their students, the whole Manda Oskin Baraisa, and all of those who occupy themselves in Araisa, the Torah. The, again, an Aramaic word for Torah, no exchange of letters over here, but do you see inside of Araisa a Hebrew word?
Or
light. So the Torah is called light. We speak Torah Ora. Torah is light. Malchut Alma, the king of the world, Yivarech Atom, bless them. May he yafish chayehon, give them long life. Yaskin yomehon, many days. Yitim orchal lishnehon, and they be, what I say, yitim orchal lishnehon, length to their years, he is parkun, and they should be save the Ishtezvot and redeem Kol Oka from all distress, and Kol Marin Bishin, and from all evil things. Marin Divishmaya, Master in Heaven. Again, Shmaya is Shamayim, Heaven. Yehei B'Sadhon, be in their support. The Cholzman, for all times Ve'idon. And times, the Nomar Amen, let us say Amen. Yehei B'Sadhon, Sa'ad is support. In modern Hebrew, the word C-U-D is a section of the hospital, which is rehab. It's called CUD in Hebrew. Now, and then we have a second prayer, and it says, when praying in private, omit the following two paragraphs, which gives us the idea that these two prayers that are coming afterwards are prayers for the congregation. And if you take a look, you see inside it's a prayer for the congregation, for all of those who are there, every single person, we ask that they be saved, etc., etc. That's this next paragraph of Kumpur Khan. And then comes Mishaberach, the prayer of the Chazan. Often the first two are said silently. I don't know if it's just because they're Aramaic and it's more difficult, and therefore they're not said. Or number two, Mishaberach is said, often it's a Chazan Shapis over here, that the Chazan says this out loud. The Hebrew is there, and it says, who is the prayer for? For the people, men, women, children, everyone, those who dedicate the synagogues, and those who enter to pray. In other words, you have to have both. Those who provide, and those who are there. Sometimes people do both. And those who give lamps for lighting and wine for Kiddush and Havdalah. Wow. There used to be, in old times, you know that the Ner Tamid, and there's some shuls that actually still have a Ner Tamid, they do it specifically, an oil-burning Ner Tamid. There's a shul in Yerushalayim that I saw that has, everything's modern there, but they have a Ner Tamid, an oil Ner Tamid, and giving the lamps for the lighting for the Ner Tamid and for the other lights in the shul, and wine for Kiddush Abdullah. I want to stop here, but I'm going to come back to the lamps for lighting. I had a cousin who passed away, who survived concentration camp, my cousin Herman, and he, after the war, drew a map of the city, my father's city, his city, and it was a small city, and around the Polish cities had a Renick in the center. People lived around it, and then there were rows of houses in various places. And he drew a map of the city, and he had the name of every single person who lived in that house. He, even in his map that he drew, he showed a two-story house for his house. And my grandfather's house was a one-story house. I thought, what a chutzpah of him to do something like that. Anyway, I was in the city there, and I saw, in fact, his house was a two-story house, and it was still standing. My father's house was not there, but that's a story for another time. And then the rows behind, and there were the names of all the people in all of the houses that lived there. And I said to him, Herbert, how in the world did you know the name of every single person in every single house? And he told me, because Friday afternoon, as a young boy, he went to the houses to collect candles for shul. So he knew every single person, every single house. Now, he didn't put, you know, in capital letters, those who gave lots of money, and in small letters, who gave small. But he had the name of every single person and where they lived. To me, it was pretty spooky. And so this prayer for those, and for the wine for Kiddush and Havdalah, those who give food to the transient guests and charity to the poor. As we know, there was in the old time shul what was called the Hefker in Europe. Hefker means ownerless, and it was like a room next to the shul in which the poor people came and they ate. And there was food provided for them. We make Kiddush on Friday night. The Ashkenaz custom to make Kiddush Friday night in the shul came from that. Because the people that were the transients would go there immediately after davening, and therefore Kiddush was made for them before they went to eat. And everyone who occupies themselves in the needs of the community, may God bless them, reward them, take from them all sickness, give them good health, forgive their sins, bless them, prosper their work and the work of all Israel, their brethren. And let us say, once again it says, Amen. Now, there are two Yikum Purkans, and I had a teacher, Rabbi Wasserman, I've mentioned many times, who had a wonderful sense of humor, at least I think so. And he was asked, how come there are two Yikum Purkans? And he said, there are two Yikum Purkans because in case one got lost, there would always be one left. So, and then somebody said, how come there's only one Mishaberach? And he answered, the other one got lost. Okay, so once again, I like that. And have been infected by that.
Did you get some parts lost?
From what I just said, you lost part of
it. No, but I'm being serious. I'm really happy you just said
that.
But when we do this,
mm-hmm.
we are praying by transference. Probably not the right word. For the country, for the leaders of the country, right? Because this was for the leaders of the congregation. Now, in our shul, we do this here part in Hebrew. Then we do more in Hebrew for the country and the president, etc., etc. And then we translate it a third time into English, which lasts...
Well,
I don't know how much time. But it seems to me that some of it is added because the congregation has added it, especially English. That we're repeating, with the understanding that most of us don't understand word for word in Hebrew. Perhaps one of the thoughts should be for the committee that oversees the service that we are really doing this three times.
My only comment at this moment can be, it's a very good suggestion.
Okay. Yes.
And at this moment.
Okay.
So now we come for the prayer for the government, and while it's not printed in the in this siddur, in the Birnbaum, a prayer for the state of Israel, and in the art scroll, it is. Not this art scroll, it's not printed at all. There's a note saying in many congregations a prayer for the welfare of the state is recited by the Rabbi Chazan or Gabbai at this point. And there's no mention of a prayer here for the government. In this is the Rabbinical Council of America art scroll sitter. This is, let's say, my rabbinic organization has a prayer for the state of Israel and has a prayer for the government inside of here and also has a prayer for the Chayalim, for the soldiers of the Israeli Defense Forces. It doesn't have one for the American armed forces in this. So what does all of this say? This whole discussion of a prayer for the government, etc., is there are different views about it. So let's just say the obvious. The prayer for the state of Israel did not take place before 1948. There was a prayer for the Jewish people, but there was no state of Israel prayer. If you go and you take a look at Old Sidurim, I haven't seen any here, but I have seen it very times, a prayer at this time for the Tsar and the Tsarina. That's there. If I find one here, I'm going to save it just to show you there's a prayer. Why? Because it's a prayer for the government. And in the footnote in here, it gives the following explanation. Hanosein Chua, on page 379, Hanosein Chua has undergone some verbal variations in the course of time. The custom to pray for the welfare of the government is based on Jeremiah 29:7. Seek the welfare of the country where I have sent you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, for your welfare depends on its welfare. The prayer is composed of excerpts from Psalms 145, 144, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Isaiah. Abu Dram wrote in the 14th century, it is the custom to bless the king and to pray to God that he may give him victory. So this, the sources for this prayer are very, very old. In other words, the book of Yirmiyahu. It's from the Tanakh, that we're supposed to pray for the government. There are many places which not only don't do it, but they would refuse to do so. The prayer for the state of Israel, there are people who say, that's not a religious state. We don't pray for it. So these prayers, there is controversy about whether or not one says these prayers. So I want to read you from bottom line, there was a slander brought against the Jewish people that they, during their services, they pray that the king be destroyed, etc., the king be harmed, and they said quite the opposite. We have a prayer for the benefit of our leader, whatever the leader may be. So that is what takes place over here. Again, the prayer for the state of Israel, just to point out, the prayer for the state of Israel was composed by one of the great Jewish writers of modern time, and that was by Shai Agnon. It does not say it over here, but Ben Gurion asked Agnon to write a prayer for the state of Israel. It combines in it many of the aspects of the hope for the return to the land of Israel and protection, and it says in it a statement which can be controversial. It says that Israel is reishis tzmichas geulaseinu, the beginning of the flowering of our redemption. In other words, we are saying at that time, in the English translation, the first flowering of our redemption, we are saying that what? That the modern state of Israel is the beginnings of the time of Mashiach, beginning of the times of the redemption. Not everyone agrees to it. You don't have to be Nature Karta to be opposed to that. There are those who say the state of Israel is evil, and that all the world evil comes to the Jewish people because there is such a terrible entity as the state of Israel. Okay, we don't really have to discuss that or address that, but there are those who say Israel is a wonderful country, it's a great to have a haven for Jewish people, but it's not what you say it is. It isn't the flowering of redemption. So there's a lot of controversy about the prayer for the state of Israel. There are those who say that it is the flowering of redemption, others not. And I have to tell you that even in, let's call it Yeshiva University, which is a very Zionistic school, Rabbi Lamb, who was the president, the immediate president, he said that he didn't believe in saying Reishis Tzmichas Gula Seinu. He believed, of course, a prayer for the state of Israel, but to say it's the beginning of the flowering of our redemption, he said, how do you know? We hope it is, but you can't say that it definitely is. You, in other words, you're telling everybody that this is what it is. So there are those who would say, based on that, Sheyihiyeh Reishis Tzmichas Gula Seinu. We want it to be the beginning of our flowering, of our redemption. But I can't say I know exactly what God's plan is. To me, it looks like that. To me, seeing the miracle of the state of Israel and its existence and what Israel has done and accomplished, I think it's unbelievable. I think that's what it is. I only pray that it should be. Anyway, so there's controversy about this, saying it or not. Okay, and then we come to the blessings of the new moon, which we will save for another time. And if you take a look on page 454 in the art scroll, just to point something that I was actually asked this Shabbat. The gray letters. Okay, the section in gray. So what is this? If you take a look at it, it is the Kel Moleh, the memorial prayer. So it says on the last day of each festival on Yom Kippur, Yizkor is said at this point. And as we know, that Yizkor is now said on Yom Tov times. And then it says in the notes, in many congregations, Kel Moleh Rachamim is recited at this point for those who have passed away during the year, and in many congregations for those whose yahrzeit falls during the coming week. The one reciting the prayer holds or touches the Torah while doing so. So if you saw this Shabbos, I said a Kel Moleh for someone who had yahrzeit during the coming week. It's not found in the Birnbaum Siddur as being there. The Birnbaum Siddur does not have the Kel Moleh. It immediately goes to the paragraph afterwards, Avarach means may the merciful Father, Father of compassion. That's what's there. So it says here in many congregations two things. Number one, a Kel Moleh is made for those who passed away during the year, because in some congregations a Kel Moleh is made for those in that congregation who passed away. There are some places in which they have very, very long lists of people who passed away, not just during that year, but of people that the congregation remembers at Yizkor time. And so what happened was, somebody had yahrzeit, I mean, you all know who it is, but the name is unimportant, and he said to the president that he wanted to make a Kel Moleh. So the president says, I don't know, we don't make a Kel Moleh on Shabbos. So he came to me, I said, there are some who specifically do say it's on Shabbos for the coming week. And as it says here, this is a custom in many places, either for all of those who passed away or for those who have yahrzeit during the coming week. And it fits into this part of the davening, because the next paragraph is the Avarachamim Shochein Bamromim. So I'm going to just say two sentences and then we'll stop. And the two sentences are, number one, don't trust a rabbi when he says two sentences or I'm just about to wrap it up or anything like that. There are those who say this Avarachamim prayer only two Shabbosos during the entire year. One on the Shabbos before Shavuos and one on the Shabbos before Tisha B'Av. The Shabbos before Tisha B'Av, because Tisha B'Av is the time of the mourning, the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, and therefore it is something relating to that. And others because this time period where we keep the Omer, and that's why I am unkempt for a few more days, and restrict certain things, is because it was a time in which the communities were destroyed during the Crusades. And these prayers were written during this time. And therefore, some say it only on those 2 weeks during the entire year. The rest of the custom we'll see next week. Okay.